Now, our speaker tonight, Eric Huntsman, has a PhD in ancient history and classics from the University of Pennsylvania. The family and property of Livia Drusilla. Anybody know who she was? Well, he's told me, but I don't remember. His master's degree thesis was 4th Century Marriage, Motherhood, and Power, the Role of Women in the Macedonian Court. So you go from Greek in your master's to Latin in your PhD work. I'm jealous. He's been a full-time faculty member since 1994 here at BYU and currently is a professor of ancient scripture in religious education. He was an Alcuin Fellow here at BYU and a William Penn Fellow at the University of Pennsylvania. He has published together with Richard Holzapfel and Thomas Wayman, Jesus Christ and the World of the New Testament, 2006 Deseret Book. If you want a little coffee table book and research source for your New Testament studies, I would recommend that one. He's married to Elaine Scott. They have two children. I know that 13 years ago, he was my daughter's bishop in a ward here in town. He also sings in the Tabernacle Choir and is missing his Tabernacle Choir rehearsal tonight, which means he won't be allowed to sing on Sunday, unfortunately. That's what he just told me. I'm also told that by the end of fourth grade, he had read one encyclopedia all the way through. He plays the piano and violin. He also runs and lifts weight. You might see him jogging around the streets of Provo very early in the morning. This is Eric Huntsman, the scholar and the church member, the singer, the musician, and our speaker tonight. Brother Honey, brother, I can't even say it. Brother Huntsman.
Thank you, Paul. Sometimes, you know, it seems like this form of introduction is a little tedious, but I'm glad Paul did that because I think many of you looked at the schedule and said, Eric, who is this person? Let me tell you a little bit about myself via Brother Nibley. I have come to understand that it has become somewhat part of the genre of speaking about Brother Nibley to share Nibley anecdotes and how you know him. Now, here I am considerably handicapped because I'm a little bit younger than some of my colleagues who are his students. I started BYU in 1983 when Professor Nibley was already emeritus, but I did get one class with him in the fall of 1984. I was in a period of crisis. I had had a head-on collision with calculus, and my dreams of becoming a medical doctor were crumbling around me, and I had to do something else. I had one semester before my mission, so I decided to take a Greek class that I'll talk about in a moment from Wilfred Griggs, and I looked in the honors catalog, and there was Pearl of Great Price from Hugh Nibley. Now, I had read some of Hugh Nibley's works at a fairly young age. I was always interested in these kind of things. I had read his approach to the Book of Mormon, Since Gomorrah, and some other things in high school. So I signed up for this class that was supposed to be about the Pearl of Great Price. But lecture after lecture proved to be about anything but. We would hear about plate tectonics, catastrophic extinctions. That actually was connected to the creation story somehow. Entropy in physics. I loved his description of if it weren't for the atonement of Jesus Christ, entropy would grind the universe to a halt. Mud Age Mesopotamia. Now that's an unfair characterization. I'm a classicist and everything good is Greek and Roman. And when I was in grad school and had colleagues in my ancient history program that were doing cuneiform and chicken scratch kind of things like Paul does, we would always talk about the earliest thing that was possibly interesting was Bronze Age Aegean. So anything earlier than that was Mud Age Mesopotamia. I remember his midterm. I don't remember what the questions were. It was in a blue book, and we had three or four questions to answer. And mine came back. This is the one of only two classes I got a B-plus in college. I got a B-plus in his Pearl of Great Price class, and I don't know why. Because my blue book came back, and all of his comments, his marginalia, were in hieroglyphics and Arabic. So what I did wrong was unclear. Our final exam was to read Spencer Kimball's article, The False Gods We Worship, and write an essay on it, which actually was a very, very good exercise. But I do remember, you know, you've heard the good and the bad of Brother Nibley. I mean, the good is obviously that he's brilliant, and you want to, you know, kind of feed at the source. But he had a very stream of consciousness kind of lecturing. And whatever was interesting to him is what we talked about that day. Now, most of my experience with Brother Nibley is derivative. That is to say, my teachers were his students. And I just want to mention three quickly to introduce my topic, which is Brother Nibley and classical scholarship. Because I had three teachers who were students of his and were very formative in moving me in the direction that I went professionally. The first one was Wilfred Griggs. I had had a freshman honors colloquium from Wilfred, and it was one of these six-hour, two-semester classes that covered the world. And I didn't know it at the time, but this was the approach that Hugh Nibley took. I mean, all knowledge was fair game. So it was ostensibly 201 and 202, the two-part history of Civ sequence. But I got to appreciate Dr. Griggs quite a bit. And once again, the next year when I was in this crisis semester trying to figure out something to do with my life, I saw that Wilfred was teaching this Greek through the New Testament class. Now, this is an awful confession to make, especially when I'm being filmed. But when I was an undergraduate, I did not like BYU religion classes. And so there was this Greek through the New Testament class that was 5 credits of introductory Greek and 2 credits of New Testament. And I thought, well, I'll get out of my New Testament and I'll get to do something interesting with Dr. Griggs. That actually is how I came to fall in love with New Testament studies and ended up loving teaching religion. We learned enough Greek that semester to work our way through the Gospel of John. And it was at the end of that semester that Wilfred sat me down before I left on my mission and asked me if I had ever been interested in studying classics, which, as I said, is going to be the subject of our discussion today. When I came back from my mission and started studying Greek and Latin at BYU, I double majored. The two teachers who were probably most influential on me were Douglas Phillips and John Hall, both of whom had been students of Dr. Nibley's. And they both shared anecdotes with me that gave me a little bit more of a feel into this personality that has intrigued so many of us. Doug told me about his coming to BYU and wanting to be like Hugh Nibley. And he went down for registration, and in those days you actually went to little desks where people had little cards. And Hugh Nibley was sitting there with little cards, I guess. I don't know what you did with those cards. We did it on phone. Now students do it on the internet. But I guess Doug introduced himself to Dr. Nibley and said he wanted to do the ancient world. And he just looked up and said, study Greek and Latin, and looked down. And that's what Doug did. And Doug became one of our fine, fine Hellenists that we've had here at BYU. My teacher, John Hall, is primarily a Roman historian. When he was here in the 70s as an undergraduate, he told me he used to take all the classes Brother Nibley taught. And I've heard this anecdote from other sources, and I know we've had a session that's talked about Nibley folklore, and I don't know if this was addressed in that session or not, but John said that he had had this experience. He would go to the class he had signed up with Brother Nibley, you know, every other day, and they never matched. And he knew someone else who was in another class middle of the day. He had a class in the morning, and he'd tell them what they were studying, and he finally found out that if Brother Nibley had 3 classes, one in the morning, one at noon, and one in the afternoon, he would just go from class to class and keep teaching what he had been teaching. So he'd teach in the morning, take a break, go to the next class, pick up. And so John said, I just changed my schedule, went to all 3 classes. But John, who's very much a classicist and very much in Greek and Latin, especially in Roman history, in recent years, we kind of joke over religious education that he's become a born-again New Testament person. He's really gotten interested in New Testament studies, and he's shared with me it's because when he was an undergraduate, all of these different classes he took from Brother Nibley just really awakened him to the power of the scriptural word and how ancient cultures helped us understand that. So he had a great influence on the three teachers who had such an influence on me. And as I said, all three of those were connected with this field of classical studies. And before I get into Brother Nibley's work in classical studies, I want to talk a little bit about that discipline, since that may not be one that's readily familiar to some of you. You know, when we talk about something being a classic, you might think, you know, Anne of Green Gables or Moby Dick or something. And in a broad sense, a work is a classic whenever it sets a standard that everyone follows. When a work, whether it be literature or art or music, transcends its own time period and its own culture, it's a classic. But because in Western civilization, so much of our culture is grounded in Greek and Roman civilization, traditionally the study of classics has been the study of Greek and Latin, language and literature, Greek and Roman history, Greek and Roman culture. Now, Brother Nibley, of course, did much more than just classics, but it is important that classics had a big part in his training. Because for Westerners to approach the ancient world, classics is important, I think, for two different reasons. First of all, in our cultural tradition, there are what I tell my students are the two grand pillars of Western tradition. It's the Greco-Roman classical tradition and the Judeo-Christian ethical tradition.
And so those are two cultures that we understand to a large degree intuitively because there's so much a part of our culture. And so it's a very natural jumping off place to study the ancient world. You can transition from modern Western culture to the Greek and Roman world, and then you become familiar with the ancient world, and then you can move into the Middle East or Egyptology or something like that. Of course, the other reason why classics is important, not just for the study of Greece and Rome, is because the Greeks and the Romans left us a huge corpus of literature. More Greek and Roman texts survive, perhaps, than any other culture. Some of this is serendipity, some of this is because they wrote a lot and they copied a lot. But as a result, even when you're studying Egypt or Mesopotamia or Persia, some of the sources that you'll be using are classical sources. So we at least last shift into the topic of our discussion tonight, which is Hugh Nibley's classical scholarship. I'm rather new to this. I have two big binders here that I'll wave at you on occasion. This one is his dissertation. I read it Saturday, and these are all of his classical works that I read the last two nights. So I'm now very familiar with what he did. But I was a little panicky yesterday because I didn't really have it in any kind of Sitz und Leben. I didn't have it in any kind of life context. So I picked up Boyd Peterson's biography of Brother Nibley, Hugh Nibley, A Consecrated Life, and read that yesterday. And from that, I gleaned down some notes where I'm going to walk through Brother Nibley's career and hopefully show how classical studies shaped and prepared him, how his own work in classical studies was instrumental in his later work in LDS, religious studies, and apologetics. Now, according to the biography that Brother Peterson has written of his father-in-law, Hugh Nibley went to UCLA between 1930 and 1934. Where he studied languages and history, not classics particularly, but Greek and Latin were major focuses of what he did. He did Arabic and a number of other things. He then went to the University of California at Berkeley for graduate school in 1934 to 1938, where he studied the ancient world and studied from a lot of people. But one of the things that caught my attention as I was reading over this period in his life is that at that time there was a visiting professor from the University of Chicago at Berkeley by the name of Werner Jaeger. I don't know if that name means anything to anyone, maybe Paul, maybe me, but Werner Jaeger wrote this huge three-volume work called Paideia. Paideia in Greek means the training of a child. But what it was effectively was a cultural history of Greece. And in those three volumes, Werner Jaeger went through Greek culture, particularly how literature shaped it. And, you know, for instance, he was the first one to talk about how young Greek boys received their moral education by learning Homer, etc. It was a very, very influential work. And so when Jaeger's name popped off the page as I was reading, I read the paragraph that Boyd had written about this, and he mentioned that Hugh Nibley and Werner Jaeger had just kind of connected and would spend long hours in the evenings talking about Greek culture and the influences of the Near East, etc. I thought, aha, this is the Nibley I've read, who knows all of these different things about these different cultures and is interested in how they affect human behavior. Now, Brother Nibley's dissertation was entitled The Roman Games as a Survival of an Archaic Year Cult. He completed it after his coursework in 1939. And it's, as dissertations tend to be, a very dense work. As chance had it, my daughter pulled out my dissertation Monday night. She's 13, so she didn't leave it out for long. But it was about 400 pages, and we were just kind of looking through it, and I was remembering all this research. And so one of the first things I do whenever I look at a dissertation is I always turn to the bibliography, because you get a good feel for the research that's gone into work when you see a bibliography. So Brother Nibley had two pages, and this is an old typeset face, right? This isn't in computer-generated fonts, but two pages of reference works. One, two, three, four, five, six pages of classical primary sources, and about, looks like, seven pages of secondary sources. And as I went through the list of classical sources, and I've been at this for a while now, I mean, I recognized almost all of them, but not all of them. I mean, he had amassed a great amount of information to study what was a fairly obscure religious celebration in ancient Rome. That once a year, the Romans would gather together and celebrate the new year. And then once a generation, technically every 100 years, but they did it every 110 to make sure no one was alive from the previous generation, they'd have a granddaddy of a new year celebration they called the Ludi Cycularis, the games of the age. And Brother Nibley was very interested in that, and he wrote this dissertation that looked at every single aspect of it, when it was celebrated, why it was celebrated, where it was celebrated, how it was celebrated, what was the role of the king. Now, I have read before Brother Nibley talking about the dying king and ritual combat and the role of the king at New Year. So immediately my interest was piqued, knowing that he was writing about that as late as the 60s and 70s, that he had been studying that back in the 1930s. Now, without boring you with any more details about his dissertation, I just want to share with you the impression I had as I was surveying this, because there were some very characteristic features of Nibleyan writing, I guess I'll coin a term there, that we see in all of his writing that was there in his dissertation in 1939. And I've broken it into three areas, and we're going to walk through his scholarship between the dissertation and the end of his life, and I'm going to come back to those three areas, because reading his later works and reading his devotional works have helped me understand why these three characteristics are so prominent in Nibley's work. First of all, in terms of content, I mean, it was amazing the breadth and the depth of his erudition, his learning, his scholarship. Now, a lot of us can fake it, because if you know a lot about a little, you can sound really smart. Take it from me. This is my modus operandi. You just say a lot about a lot of things and people think you know what you're talking about. And Brother Nibley, in this discussion about Roman New Year games, was talking about Icelandic sagas. I mean, the breadth was amazing. Now, usually people who have a lot of breadth don't have a lot of depth, or they rightly have a depth in their emphasis area. So I was expecting depth in the Roman material, but it was everywhere. So that's the content, both breadth and depth of erudition. Then there was the methodology. What he did in his later works was present already in 1939, which was a very pronounced comparative approach. And when I say comparative approach, it grows out of the breadth of his scholarship. He looked at different cultures, at different time periods, and drew comparisons. Now, I looked in his bibliography, and I didn't see this name, and I expected it. I'm sure that James Frazer was an influence on Nibley, even though it doesn't show up in the bibliography of that particular work. James Frazer lived between 1854 and 1941, wrote a book called The Golden Bough. The title is taken from Virgil's Aeneid, Book 6, where Aeneas and the Sibyl are about to go into the underworld. And to be able to get in the underworld and come back, they have to find this golden bough on a sacred tree in a sacred grove and pluck it and go in. Well, what Frazer did in that is he looked at what in Greek we call katabases, going downs and coming back. The greatest Greek heroes always went to the underworld and came back. I mean, going to the underworld is no big deal. We all do it. But it's the coming back that's a problem. And what he did is, Frazer did this comparative approach and looked at all these cultures, particularly in the Near East and the Mediterranean, that had this figure of the dying king. Now, I can't prove the direct influence of Frazer on Nibley because, as I said, it doesn't show up in his bibliography. But he did list Jane Harrison, Hook. These are some people who are prominent, what they call the Cambridge Ritual School. There are several scholars at Cambridge in England shortly after Frazer who picked up this comparative approach, but they focused on ritual acts as the foundation of myth and other cultural aspects. So what they would always do is they would look at different cultures and look at their religious rituals and their mythology, and they say if there's similarities, this must represent some kind of basic human pattern. And that is certainly something that Brother Nibley frequently did. Without criticism. I mean, even co-religionists of Brother Nibley's have pointed out that he is sometimes guilty of what some would call parallelomania. I mean, Jackson and Doug Salmon both have commented on this. Just because you find something in all these different cultures, can you prove or demonstrate the connection? And because so much of Brother Nibley's work is based on this mastery, this control of disparate literary traditions, Bill Hamlin has said that his methodology consists more of comparative literature than history, because he's comparing these different aspects of cultures, they appear in the written text. And there is necessarily some selectivity. Okay, so you're finding things in different cultures and different sources, and you pick out the ones that seem to support your thesis. I'm preferring to call those observations rather than criticisms, because I, as a rule, don't like to be critical of people. And as I said, I think I have some sense as why that was Brother Nibley's pattern. The third area, so we have content, we have methodology. The third area is style. And I'm a historian more than a literary person, so I don't know that I'm particularly competent to characterize his style. But as I read it, it read like everything else I read of Nibley's, you know. It was kind of like those classes I've described. You go from one and then another, and what's on his mind is what he talks about. And I was trying to find a good way to describe that. And I've come up with Herodotean. Now, that bears some explanation. But Herodotus is a 5th century Greek historiographer. He's called the father of, I'm going to call him Greek history, because clearly the author of the Deuteronomic history is the father of history. But anyway, Herodotus had this wonderful storytelling technique. Now, I know we don't think of Brother Nibley as a storyteller, although I would say he is. He's telling a great story, a story of good news. He's telling the story of the gospel. But that aside, ignore that little flaw in my comparison. Herodotus had something that he called ring composition, that as he was going from point A to Z, he'd go to B, and then he'd have a big digression, and then he'd go here, and he'd have another big digression. But he always came back to where he started, and he always ended up where he wanted to be. And so I have written in my notes here an almost Herodotean style with frequent digressions. Maybe I should call them, they're not really digressions because they're supportive of what he's doing, forays, plumbing the depths into supporting pieces of evidence, but resulting in relatively simple conclusions. The conclusion to this dissertation was a page and a half, where he just laid out 5 simple propositions. Now, as I said, I'm going to come back to this, but I think there's a reason he did that instinctively. Anyway, it's a great thing. You can find it on microfiche here at BYU. You can print it up and put it in a binder and read it one Saturday when you don't have anything to do. I had a couple other things that if I had time I'd talk about, but I don't, so I won't talk about the comparisons to the Feast of Tabernacles on page 47, or I won't talk about, when we're talking about parallel mania, that in chapter 5 he took 35 pages to talk about every kind of ritual contest in the world, starting with Iceland, and then he got to Rome and did 3 pages. We're not going to talk about those kind of things. Rather, we're going to continue onward and look at his teaching career. He took a post at the Claremont Colleges in Southern California and was there from 1939 to 42, where he was teaching a number of things, including ancient languages, history, philosophy, that kind of thing. But I'm just mentioning that teaching appointment because it was the period of 2 professional presentations and 1 short article. And at this point in his career, his professional work was strictly academic, strictly professional. At the Pacific Coast branch of the American Historical Association, at a meeting in Stanford, he gave a paper called The Origin of the Roman Dole. This is the practice in the late Republic and then, of course, in the imperial period where the Roman government handed out grain at reduced prices, sometimes free. Now, what I didn't realize until I'd read the dissertation is he addresses that issue in his dissertation, that the New Year King has as one of his responsibilities the becoming the giver of good gifts, taking care of his people, providing them with bread, if you will. He also gave a paper at the Southwest Archaeological Foundation at its meeting in San Diego on a Roman practice called acclamatio, which is the practice of the Roman mobs claiming the emperor or proclaiming a victorious general, an imperator, and that kind of thing. That also was derived from his dissertation. It was in this period that he published his first article in a fairly prestigious journal, second-tier journal called Classical Journal, 1941 edition. But it was a strange little piece. It was called New Light on Scaliger. Scaliger is a Swiss-Italian scholar of physics or something. And a very prominent, but he was a polymath. He was experienced in many fields. And Brother Nibley wrote a 4 or 5 page article on this man and why he was so great. But the reason it's important from a classical point of view is that he would use Greek and Latin to explain things from his works, and Arabic. There was this big debate about how he pronounced the name Scaliger. And there was this painting of this Mr. Scaliger where he was holding a book that had a word on it in Arabic, and Hugh read it, and it said Scaliger in Arabic or something. Okay, that's not particularly an important work. Okay, now, as many of you know, and as was mentioned in the opening prayer, between 1942 and 1945, Brother Nibley served in the military during World War II. And at the end of his service, Perhaps his most important article in the field of classical studies was published once again in Classical Journal, this fairly important journal. It was the 1945 edition. Now, I actually read that one before I read the dissertation. And the dissertation helps me understand how he did this article while he was in the military. He actually had been writing it at Claremont, and it didn't come out till the end. But when I read the article, at the end of articles, you usually, you know, have Eric D. Huntsman, Brigham Young University or something. But at the end of this article, it said, here we go, Hugh Nibley, the United States Army. Now, the reason why that bemused me till I realized he had written it some other time is he had 132 footnotes. It's a really obscure text, and I was having this hard time figuring out how he was carting these around, you know, as they were storming Normandy and things. But anyway, it was an article called Sparsiones, which is Latin for distributions, literally casting things out. It was a Roman practice that at special events like birthdays and the New Year, goes back to his dissertation, the father or the general or the king was expected to just throw out gifts. Pieces of bread, little tokens, sweetmeats, little gifts, gold coins. And it was this idea that the king is the source of what Brother Nibley calls all good gifts. It was a very well-written article. And it holds up to any of the works in classical studies that I've read in its use of sources and its methodology. I mean, there were still some moments of Herodotean or Nibleyan digressions. And it certainly was comparative, because he would look at other cultures and how they had the same idea that if you're the king, you're supposed to take care of the people. And there were interests that revealed that he was, if not a religious man, which we know he was, at least a man familiar with the Bible. On page 532, there's a reference to manna. And it was Yahweh throwing out food, okay, on his people. One of the practices in Roman sparsiones is you didn't always want to throw out food because, you know, it might go bad or something. So sometimes you just throw out little tokens, and then you'd go turn the tokens in and get a little gift basket or something. And these are called tesserae in Latin. And Brother Nibley said, this is just like in the book of Revelation, when everyone receives a white stone with his name on it, and then he can get the hidden man and all this other kind of stuff. I just want to read something from the final paragraph of this article. This is Classical Journal, issue 40, page 543. The multiple aspects of the institution, sparsiones, scattering gifts, fit nicely together, may be matched in every point with practices of other peoples, the same peculiar elements appearing in the same complex combinations. So that is that comparative approach that he so often employed. Now, he comes back from the military. And before he gets duly employed again, in 1946, he wrote a little booklet, which many of you are familiar with, No Ma'am, That's Not History, which, of course, was an answer to Fawn Brody's No Man Knows My History, her psychological critique of Joseph Smith. And this brought him to the attention of people such as Witzel. And he was convinced to apply and to teach at BYU, where he taught from 1946 to 75, at which point he became emeritus and just taught an occasional Prograde Prize class like the one I sat on in. Now, I've broken his career into two periods. In 1959 and 1960, he took a sabbatical and went to Berkeley. And as I read through Brother Peterson's biography and then looked at the publication record and really tried to analyze what he wrote before and what he wrote afterwards, I've decided that that year at Berkeley was really pivotal to him. Before he went to Berkeley on sabbatical, he wrote three pieces that appeared on the classical bibliography that Brother Hoskinson very kindly provided to me, but only one of them, I think, is strictly classical. He wrote something called The Arrow Hunter and the State, which is a fascinating little piece about how nomads from the north with their marked arrows are able to impose themselves on the settled agriculturalist of Mesopotamian things. And it was very interesting. I mean, I'm trained to be critical, so to me it was a little speculative, but it was very interesting. Not strictly classical. There were a couple references to Greek and Roman practices and Greek and Latin texts. It was actually more kind of Near Eastern. It appeared in a journal called the Western Political Quarterly, which I didn't know. And so I looked it up, and it turned out to be a publication of the University of Utah's Political Science Department. So it's a journal, and it was peer-reviewed, but it's not classical journal. He then wrote something called The Herocentric State, which drew upon his dissertation. And a lot of these things show up, I think, in the volume, The Ancient State. You can read a lot of those in the collected works of Hugh Nibley. Very good work, but once again, this shows where classics is for Nibley now. Classics is just one of many resources to him. So there are references to Greek and Roman practices and Greek and Latin sources, but it's not strictly a work in classical studies. But there was one that was published in Western Speech in 1956, which was very, very significant. And I'm glad I read this because it explains some of the training that I've received. It was published in Western Speech, which I think comes out of Oregon. Once again, it's not a top journal, but it's a peer-reviewed journal. It was called Victorioso Loquacitas, Victorious Eloquence, The Rise of Rhetoric and the Decline of Everything Else. 57, page 57 through 82, it's a big piece. And in it, he walks through three stages of, it's really about epistemology, it's really not about rhetoric. It's about how we know what we know. So he starts out by talking about the mantic worldview. Now, mantic comes from the Greek word mantis for prophet. If you need help remembering that, think of a praying mantis. A praying mantis is a praying prophet. And the mantic worldview is that there's absolute truth, but we can't arrive at it on our own. It needs to be revealed to us. And so he went through the evidence to show that the early Greeks were a mantic society. And then he had the sophic view and the sophistic view. Now the sophic view, that comes from the Greek word sophos, which means wise. Wisdom is sophia, so it's a wise man. And he starts with these seven figures in the late Archaic age called the seven sages, who were sophoi. He says, now these men did not throw away religion and revelation, but they were just so naturally brilliant that they just kind of did it on their own. But the problem was, in the next generation, people tried to be sophoi, and they couldn't quite make it. And so they were sophistic. Now, some of you know the word sophistry, which is usually connected with rhetoric in a negative sense. Rhetoric is what? The art of persuasion. It's the way that we write and speak persuasively. Now, we have a hard time getting a beat on rhetoric in modern society because it's in an abysmal state right now. I mean, our politicians think the way to speak persuasively is A, to lie to us, B, to just tell us what we want, or C, to talk in little sound bites for the news. You know, in the old days, you persuaded people by speaking intelligently and cleverly and beautifully. Now, as Latter-day Saints, we have a fairly recent model that helps us get a grip on this. Elder Maxwell, for instance, is a great example of pretty good rhetoric. I mean, you may not like alliteration, but there are a lot of other good rhetorical things Brother Maxwell did. The way he used language. Now, the reason he wasn't a sophist is because it's not just how he said, it's what he said. The depth of what he was saying was more important than how he said it. President Hinckley was actually a pretty good rhetorician as well. It's what I would call a middle form of rhetoric, Attic rhetoric, for those of you who do Greek rhetoric. He was classically trained, by the way. In fact, this is a quick anecdote on the side. One of my other teachers, Roger McFarland, well, actually, we were missed each other. He came to teach at BYU my last year, and then I was his colleague for a while when I was in classics. But there's a form in Greek called the partitive genitive. So if you do French, it's like du lait, of milk. It's when you take a part of the whole. And President Hinckley used this all the time. There is much of good in the world today. And so Roger used to call that the Hinckley genitive when he was trying to teach his students that. Where am I? Rhetoric. We're talking about rhetoric. Rhetoric, the art of persuasion, when used for good ends, is a positive thing. The problem was there were a group of these professional teachers that were called the sophist who thought you could use it for any ends whatsoever. Now, the difference between a sophos, a wise man, and a sophistes, a sophist, is a sophos is someone who possesses or is characterized by sophia, wisdom. A sophistes, that construction in Greek literally means the one who does the wisdom thing or makes wisdom. And there's a fellow named Protagoras, and Brother Nibley talks about him at great length in this article, who said that he could make the weaker argument the stronger. He could speak so persuasively that he could argue anything and make you believe it. He's also supposedly the one who said, man is the measure of all things, who introduced the idea of moral relativism into Western culture. That there's not absolute truth or absolute good, but it's whatever we want or whatever's important to us. So anyway, Brother Nibley walked through this and talked about sophistry. Now, this is a professional article in a professional journal. He doesn't make any overt religious references. But it was significant to me that I could read an LDS subtext in this better than in any of his previous work. Because when he talks about philosophy plus rhetoric equals sophistry, or he talks about how sophistry misleads people, as the title of his article says, leads to the decline of everything, I immediately thought of Book of Mormon antichrists and how often they're described as using flattering words to mislead the people. And this is a segue into what I'm going to do in about 15 minutes as I wrap up, trying to understand why the content, the methodology, and the style of Brother Nibley was the way it was. He also gave a hint of some things he was going to do in some other professional publications, not in classics, but in Christian and Jewish publications. For instance, he talked about how post-apostolic Christianity gave rhetoric a new lease on life on page 72. Anyway, very interesting article. But it's probably not insignificant that just a year and a half later, in a letter to a man named Paul Springer, so this is Nibley to Springer, 24 May 1958, you can read the quote in Peterson's biography, page 153, he wrote, "I have got some important communication from some big shots in the business, but none of them were in response to any of my Gentile exertions, which were merely written to set the stage for the other stuff." Parsing that sentence takes a little effort, but what it seems to be saying is people knew about him and were interested in his work, important people. But what's important to him is not the Gentile exertions, the stuff for the professional journals. Instead, those things that he had written and studied up to that point were merely written to set the stage for the other stuff. Now, the year after he made that comment to Springer in that letter, he went on a sabbatical at Berkeley. And some important things came out of that year. He wrote an article called Christian Envy of the Temple, which appeared in Jewish Quarterly in 1959, a very important article, not strictly a classical one. And according to Peterson's biography, at the end of that year, he was invited to stay on and join the faculty there. And Nibley declined and returned to BYU. And I thought this was interesting. This is Peterson, page 416. He returned to BYU at this request, or on this basis, that he only teach scriptural-related classes from that time on. Now, this is doing a lot of reading between the lines. But what's happened here? He's done all of this work in professional publications. He's spent a year at Berkeley. He's met all these people. He's done all this research. And he comes back to BYU more convinced than ever that what really matters is the gospel, the scriptures, the restoration. It's an assumption. He wrote a few things after he got back that were in important journals. The Passing of the Church, 40 Variations on an Unpopular Theme. He wrote an article called The 40 Days on the 40-Day Ministry in Vigili Christiani. And then he went to Yale in 1963 and once again revisited this issue of rhetoric and sophistry. And this time he talked about those three worldviews more explicitly. Three shrines, mantic, sophic, and sophistic, the confrontation of Greek and Christian religiosity. This was to an LDS students group at Yale called the Deseret Lectures. And it could have been a very big group, I would think. In 1963, how many LDS students were at Yale? But they have been transcribed and published, and it was the biggest thing that I read. I mean, it's this much in transcription. So it was a very serious lecture series. And as I said, this kind of discussion of what happened in ancient Greece, epistemologically, how Greece changed its understanding of what was true and how you learn and how you know, moving from a mantic or revealed worldview to a sophistic worldview, has informed my own teaching and understanding of some classical literature. Because I was TAing for John Hall back in 1989, Classical Civ 110, and we were studying Sophocles. And John taught a particular interpretation of Oedipus the King that I hadn't heard before, but I now know he got it from Nibley. But I liked it so much, I've taught it ever since as well. Now, I don't know how many of you remember your Oedipus the King, and if you don't, I'll just quickly remind you. This is Oedipus, the king of Thebes, who married his mom and killed his dad, and it's kind of a nasty backstory. But in Oedipus the King, in a Greek tragedy, you're always looking for a mistake in judgment. what we call hamartia. Aristotle said it was a mistaken judgment the tragic character commits, which brings all of this on his head. And it's always got to take place in the play. So Oedipus's earlier killing of his father and unknowingly marrying his mother is not the mistake. That was just the bad hand that fate dealt him. But the mistake was that in this play, Thebes is suffering from a pestilence. There's a plague. And so they send off to Delphi to ask the god Apollo what's wrong, and the embassy comes back and says, there's a pollution. Someone's done something so bad in Thebes that the gods are unhappy with us. And so Oedipus tries to find out who it is. And his mistaken judgment is, he says, whoever's responsible for this, I don't even care if he lives in my own home, at my own hearth, let him be accursed, may he never see good things again, emphasize the see part. And he calls down this curse unknowingly on himself. And as he's getting all worked up in this curse, the prophet Tiresias comes in and says, you better be quiet. You don't know what you're talking about. And Oedipus, who had initially sent a delegation to Delphi to ask the gods what was wrong, suddenly becomes the big critic of prophets. Oh, Tiresias, who are you? You're a blind old prophet. Who told you? A bunch of birds? Oh, you were cutting up a liver and saw how it fell on the floor, and that tells you who the person is? You're just, you say you're a prophet, it's just charlatanry. And the way Brother Nibley taught that in this lecture series was that we have a conflict in the figures of Tiresias the prophet and Oedipus between the mantic worldview and the sophistic worldview. Oedipus is a classic sophist. He is smart. The way he got in power after he killed his father and before he married his mother was that he had defeated the Sphinx who had asked these riddles. And so he demonstrated his cleverness. And several times in the play, Sophocles has Oedipus say, I'm smart, I'm this, I'm that. And Tiresias will say, oh, you're such a clever speaker. You're so good at rhetoric. And so you have this conflict between the manic worldview and the sophistic worldview. That actually influenced me so much. Not only did I, you know, teach Oedipus the King that way ever since. When I spoke at my own graduation, I decided to use that play and Brother Nibley's interpretations as the basis of my talk. I talked about Christian humanism because, you know, secular humanism was all the rage in the 80s and everyone was concerned about it. President Benson was concerned about it. And that was very much the sophistic worldview. But we have another model for humanism. You know, humanism is the idea that man is essentially the center of the universe and he's got divine potential, or great potential at least. Christian humanism would say, yeah, man is important because God made him. And in an LDS context, man is important because he has the seeds of divinity in him. And in fact, I think Moses chapter 1 is a great example of this. Moses, within two columns, looks at two extremes, right? He sees God and the majesty of creation, and he says, wow, I'm nothing. I never realized that man was nothing before. But then Satan shows up, and he says, I'm a son of God. And you see this kind of proper view, awe and deference in the face of God, but confidence and potential because of who we are. That was the last really classical thing that I could find in Brother Nibley's Vita. I mean, there were a couple other things that he wrote. He wrote an odd little thing in Western Quarterly called Tenting, Tolling, and Taxing, which was interesting, but it wasn't clearly classical anymore. So these are the summations I made as I was reviewing my notes earlier today. If we were to look at Brother Nibley's career from a purely academic, professional, secular point of view, we would say that his best academic work, as opposed to the specifically LDS or apologetic work that he did for home consumption, was before 1960, except for those things that he wrote for Jewish Quarterly, etc., that were specifically in the areas of religious studies and history, what his real interest was at the time. Even before that time, his prime piece, that article on distribution, Sparsiones, in 1945, is the only one that was actually published in a really high-profile journal. Now, classics, of course, continued to be important to his work. Classical sources and literature continue to be one of the several substrates upon which he drew. Every other culture was as well. But it was never again his focus. Nevertheless, those characteristics I said that I discerned in his dissertation in terms of his content, methodology, and style continued. Even in his more religiously focused works, they're present. Deep, broad and deep, methodologically concerned with parallelism, and of course the style that we all know. But I'm beginning to believe it was because of his own deep-seated religious convictions. So let's go back to those three areas again and see if I can make some suggestions. We've mentioned that his content is characterized by erudition, both breadth and depth. And today I looked up two passages in the Doctrine and Covenants which I thought reflected Brother Nibley very well. We're told in Doctrine and Covenants 90:15, study and learn, become acquainted with all good books, with languages, tongues, and people. And Doctrine and Covenants 93:53, obtain a knowledge of history. Of course, you know, we're not Hugh Nibley, and none of us have those mental or linguistic gifts. But each of us at our own level, and with whatever abilities the Lord has given us, we are supposed to be doing these things. And I think that was the drive he had. Learn everything he could about languages and books and cultures and people. In terms of this methodology, which sometimes earned him a little criticism, this comparative approach, two possibilities. Part of it, I think, was a real conviction that the human family was exactly that, the human family. That we were all descended from Adam and Eve, that we were all descended from the same group. I mean, this kind of comparative approach worked for Brother Nibley because he believed the Mesopotamians and the Norsemen and the Greeks and everyone came from the same source. And so it made sense that if they had similar practices, rituals, beliefs, that they came from a common ancestor. I think there might be something else, and this is not academically a good methodology, but if it's true, it's true. Sometimes when you know the truth, you look and you recognize it when you see it. And so the charge that he was sometimes selective with the evidence may be true, but because he knew what to look for whenever he saw those pieces of evidence, that's what he put in his footnotes. Does that make any sense? So when he sees some of these patterns in these different cultures, he immediately, with his gospel foundation, said, that's the truth. Now, you can't argue that in a professional journal. That doesn't make an academic argument. But it makes a, I almost said a homiletic argument, but that doesn't work for some of you. That makes a testimony-inspiring argument. And I'll tell you, the thing that weighed on me the most heavily was my own Christology. Because I'm so convinced that everything in the gospel and everything in our lives is pointing us to the Savior. And, you know, we all have different styles and different emphases. And Brother Nibley wasn't in-your-face, Billy Graham kind of evangelical Christian. I'm accused in my classes of being a little evangelical because I just want to see Jesus everywhere. Hugh Nibley did see Jesus everywhere. He just described him differently. When I went back and looked at that Roman New Year king and all of these things that he had in common with the Cambridge Ritual School, and looked at the king who came and died for his people and returned, the king who was the giver of all good gifts, who showered bread upon his people from heaven, who was the source of life. Who here doubts that Brother Nibley had Jesus Christ in mind? And he saw in each of those cultures a type or an anticipation of the Savior. In terms of his style, his digressive, detailed explorations of all these different topics within the same argument, but coming up with fairly simple conclusions. I wonder whether Brother Nibley had as his motivation there, the gospel consists of, comprises, and embraces all truth. All is fair game. All is important. All we should have the goal to circumscribe into one whole. And yet the ends of the gospel and its purposes are simple. We should go out there and look at all history and all cultures and all languages and all art, and that's a pretty tall order, but the conclusions we draw from that should be simple. God lives. Jesus is the Christ. We are his children. There's a plan for us. Could it have been that simple for him? I have a couple of personal reflections that I would like to share with you as I close this discussion tonight. First of all, I have to share a little bit of my own biography with you. As I mentioned, some of Brother Nibley's students shepherded me into classics, and I came back to BYU in 1994, and from 1994 to 2003 taught classics. But kind of like Brother Nibley had an experience when he was at Berkeley in 59 and 60, which led him to turn to full-time service in the gospel and to writing about the scriptures and away from classics. I had an experience in 2003 which changed the course of my career. Now, I'm no Hugh Nibley. I do not have and never will have his gifts, and I will make a much smaller impact than he will. But I wrote an article in a volume for Richard Holzapfel and Thomas Wayment in 2003 on the Roman trial of Jesus that started out, like some of Brother Nibley's early works, as a very classical piece. They asked me to talk about the Roman legal process that was the trial of Jesus. And I worked on that for several weeks. And the night before it was due, it felt wrong. I had written 20, 30-some pages. And in some despair, I just said, I'm going to take a break and read the scriptures, and pulled open the Book of Mormon and began to flip open. And page, time after time, I came to a prophecy of Nephi's or prophecies of Jacob regarding the passion of our Lord, how he would be spit upon and beaten and smitten and scourged and die for us. And suddenly I realized that scholarship without a soul was empty. And I rewrote that article. I kept all the Roman historical and legal stuff in it, but I used Book of Mormon scriptures to kind of frame it. And I remember thinking after that, that's what I really want to do. And so I gave up a field that I loved for something I loved better. Boyd Peterson entitled the biography of his father-in-law A Consecrated Life. And Brother Nibley took all the skills he had, including his classical background, for a greater end. And it's not always going to be to write about religion or to build faith in explicit ways. I mean, the end that the Lord may have for you is to be the best engineer or the best mom or the best teacher or the best artist that you can be. But this concept of consecration that Brother Nibley so exemplified is something I think we should all strive to attain. That whatever gifts and skills and knowledge God gives us are to be used in His service. And if that means you change course in the middle of your life or you stay the course throughout your life, these are His gifts and His talents that we're not giving to Him, but we're simply returning to Him. I have a testimony of this. I have a testimony of a good God who loves us and gives us each different gifts and gives us through His Son Jesus the command to love and serve one another. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen.